It can only be Millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with John Carter. John is, as it says, a Canadian content creator, writer. John, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Hey, I'm Debs. It's an absolute honor to have been invited on Millennial. Like, is it, so this is the 10th one?
Yes, it is.
That's incredible. So I'm primarily a Substacker. I write postcards from Barsoom, which a few times a month I'll publish a several thousand word essay on. It can be anything from Canadian military history to how to colonize Mars to the cognitive dimensions of the hemisphere hypothesis and how that maps onto politics to the re-enchantment of the world. I jump all over the place because I have ADHD and want to keep my audience from getting bored by talking about the same thing every single week and keep myself from getting bored as well.
How long have you been doing this and what's your background?
So I've been writing for, well, I've been writing on Substack for maybe 2.5 years now. My background, I spent most of the last decade as an academic, working in a STEM field. I try not to be much more specific than that because I'm still trying to maintain pseudonymity. Yeah. I've done a bunch of other things besides that, you know, teaching English overseas and was in the military for a while. And I've had a reasonably varied career, I think.
All right. And what drew you to Substack? I'm interested in talking about Substack as a platform because I think it's still very new. And I think a lot of people aren't familiar with it. They haven't visited. And I want to spread awareness of it because I think it's a bloody good platform.
It's amazing. It's growing quite rapidly, which, I mean, there's some growing pains because I the quality of the commentary has, I think, declined a little bit as the audience has grown, probably inevitably. But, you know, initially what drew me to Substack was just, you know, I used to blog quite some time ago. I was looking for a creative outlet, somewhere I could sort of scream into the ether. A friend of mine started Substacking. He writes the Slabland Stalker Substack. Goes by Rurik Skywalker these days. So he suggested that I get into it, and it was in the middle of lockdowns. I was immensely bored. My employer at the time was, they were doing their best to try and get me fired for refusing the jib-jab. So I was in a pretty bad headspace, I think. So I just started the blog with kind of a random name. People are always looking for, like, you know, the deeper meaning behind postcards from Barsoom, but I just thought it was, you know, amused me at the time. Started writing, you know, initially primarily about the sort of state of academia and trying to understand, like, you know, how the academic world had fallen to the degree that it had, all the different influences, you know, economic and sociological and philosophical and structural and so on, the demographics, sort of like looking at it from every angle that I could. And then it started growing. People liked it. And then it became kind of a familiar social media game of, you know, how do I increase my audience, you know? Because a big line go up always feels good, right? And then about a year in, I found myself unemployed, and I decided, with the urging of several friends, to turn on monetization, and I was blown away, actually, at the response from my then, at that point, much smaller readership than it is now. The number of people who were like, shut up and take my money. And I'm like, I'm not even putting things behind a paywall, and you're just going to give me money to write? And they were like, yes, keep writing. And I was like, okay, I can do that. So that has been a transformative aspect of the Substack platform for writers, is it gives them a possibility of sort of directly supporting themselves with their writing by developing a relationship with their audience. So, you know, without having to worry about keeping the advertisers happy, right? So you can just write what you want, what your audience likes, and make a living, actually, in some rare cases. And the other thing about it that I find really interesting is actually just that it is a subscription model that uses an email notification system, which means that you can go weeks. I've gone up to 3 months, actually, without publishing anything. I'm not bragging about that, but that was just like, you know, I just wasn't blogging for that period. And then you come back, you publish something, all of your readers get it. And if anything, they're often more interested to see what you have to say because they haven't heard from you in so long. And that is transformative in an important way, because the previous blogging model, you had to keep people coming back every day, multiple times a day, even, in order to, so that they wouldn't forget you. And that tended to encourage this very low quality, clickbaity, BuzzFeedy kind of content. Because you just, you know, it's not possible to put out high quality writing on such a regular basis. But with the notification system that Substack has developed, you can be much more thoughtful. You can polish things up. You can really consider what you're writing about, put real time into it. And some writers, quite a few writers, unfortunately, are still kind of doing the clickbaity thing, I find, on Substack, because they haven't quite, I think, emotionally, like, adjusted to the new model. But, like, a lot of writers have sort of figured that out. And they are taking their time, thinking things through, putting real effort into it, which means that the overall quality of the writing is improving over time. The thought is becoming deeper, more interesting. It's leading, I think, to something of a renaissance, actually. And I believe it's still in the very early stage.
So you're very optimistic about this. I mean, I agree. I share your optimism. I think that the great thing about Substack is that it is fashioned in such a way as to encourage quality and cultivate quality. Mm-hmm. I think it's been done in reaction to the, as you say, clickbaity, crappy nature of so much social media content creation, where it is a matter of quantity. For sure, it's quantity over quality. And so you end up with a lot of noise. I think Substack, in many different subtle ways, pushes in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. And so you got a lot of very thoughtful writers. I mean, and I know what you mean about spending time on something, taking time to do it right, to get it right. I do actually wish that Substack would do what Patreon did and allow people to be paid per essay rather than per week, per month, or whatever. Because I think
I saw, this is maybe like a year ago, a sort of debate over that with, I think it was Hanish. It might have been Chris Best, but I think it was Hanish. But it was people in the Substack dev team. And they thought about this, actually. They have been reluctant to bring out a sort of like per piece content model because they don't want to cannibalize the core business. I think they're of the opinion that if they gave writers the ability to do that, then readers would be much less likely to just subscribe, which would mean in the long run less money in the writers' pockets. And because, of course, Substack's entire revenue model is scraping off a little bit of the money that goes into the writers' pockets, it's less money for Substack. So that's their reasoning.
I could see them also thinking that it would push people to write garbage for the sake of getting some money that month.
Yes, but exactly.
The problem is the opposite, where if you don't write something 1 month, then people understandably are annoyed with you. Like for 3 months of the year, I have to do millennials, so I can't write as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an awkward thing. And I always
It takes you 3 months to organize this. That's incredible.
Yes, yes, it does.
Wow.
Because I'm doing everything myself, so except this year I had the trailer, the CGI was done by somebody else, but yeah, other than that, everything is me. So yeah, it takes 3 months for one person to organize all of this and put it together, but that means that I can't write at the same time. Mm-hmm. So this is a problem. This is why I would like that funding model. But other than that, Just because it would annoy fewer people. I think it's understandable that they're annoyed. But anyway, that's just one of my own bugbears. To talk more about Substack, you said it's causing a sort of renaissance in writing. Do you see that as being politically of any particular stripe, or do you think it's just in general?
Overall, I would say in general. Obviously, I personally think that the most interesting stuff is happening in our sphere. Whenever something comes across my timeline from the other side of the discourse, I'm usually not. I still find it interesting. You know, it's not usually very deep thought, and that's probably inevitable given the historical movement we're in right now, because you know the left remains incredibly censorious. Now, all that said, if you actually look at where the money is flowing, most of the orange checks and the occasional purple check tend to be establishment types. You'll see former CNN anchors or New York Times writers with effortless orange checks and huge amounts of engagement and mostly very low quality comments. And sometimes you kind of wonder, is this just a function of
the old George legacy Sorkin media?
Yeah, exactly. Just finding a way to sort of launder influence, on Substack by, buying large numbers of institutional group subscriptions in order to push author, their favorite author's earnings up. But in terms of the actual interesting stuff that's going on, it's all on the right. It's been for the last few years. whether that'll continue to be the case, I don't know. I'm a little worried, honestly, now that Trump won the election. Because, there's a real risk of getting kind of swallowed up into the establishment, getting co-opted and becoming cringe. That often kind of happens to dissident movements when they unexpectedly find themselves in power. Although it's much more likely that we just kind of get elbowed aside, as entryists kind of, get in.
Yeah, it didn't happen the last time. I don't think it's going to happen this time either. I don't think that we are going to feel all that vindicated by, whatever Trump does in his second term. I don't think it's certainly not going to resolve the problems of Western civilization.
No, God, no. God, no. They're so much deeper. I mean, he's got so many incredible problems you have to deal with. The war in Ukraine, for example, the absolute state of the U.S. economy. Whatever black swans they spring on him as soon as he takes power. But even aside from all of that, it remains the case that those of us who are not American citizens still have to deal with our globalist liberal puppet governments in every single one of our countries. And we're all still screwed here, actually. So the Death Star might have gotten blown up in Washington again but like, you know, the Empire survives and we still live in it. So, you know, the fight is going to go on for the foreseeable future.
Oh, yeah. And you can see, like, Trudeau sucking up to Trump in advance of but it's still, you know, it's still Trudeau. And he's still part of a Canadian establishment that is going to survive.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, and you know, even if the Trudeau government actually collapses in the next, in the near future, which is looking increasingly likely, given his deputy prime minister and finance minister, same person, Chrystia Freeland, resigned unexpectedly yesterday. His government's in total chaos. It's entirely possible that he's gone in a couple months or less. But even if that happens, I mean, they just replace him with another puppet, you know? Nothing fundamentally changes. I mean, you know, look at UK politics, same kind of thing. Like, does it really matter that you have Keir Starmer now instead of the brown jug-eared guy? Sunak, that was it. Yeah, right. I want to say Varadkar, but that was the Irish guy. Right. Or, you know, like David Cameron or Boris Johnson or whoever. It's, no, it really doesn't, because it's like the whole set of people underneath them that are actually sort of directing things fundamentally, and they're all sort of rotten. So until it's a regime complete problem that we deal with, until you remove all of them, the problem persists.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier about the you did writing at the start when you first joined Substack about the state of academia. I think that would be a topic. I mean, it's not new to many of my listeners, but nonetheless, I would like to hear your perspective on that. What do you see it as, just a field of stagnation at this point?
Oh, jeez, man. There's so many different angles you can look at it from. There's an aspect which is, you know, basically just a scam. It's a way for a large administrative caste to siphon money out of the economy while providing no actual value. You can see it as an ideological indoctrination mill. You can see it as a way of influence laundering, at least with the elite universities. If your elite professors are saying things, then you can point to that. You know, a journalist can point to that and say, oh, look at this, you know, experts say, and you can use that to support the policy you want. Similarly, the legitimacy of our ruling class actually kind of comes down to their university credentials. Like, if you look at what they themselves will point to as kind of like, well, this is why we should be in charge, right? It's not that they were born rich. It's not anything usually particularly that they did. It's the school they went to. Like, oh, I went to Harvard. I went to Yale. I went to Oxford or Cambridge or whatever. I went to University College London. You know, therefore, I am one of the elect, right? So, you know, that's an important aspect of the function that they serve inside the regime.
And what would you say about the atmosphere inside academia?
And the atmosphere inside of academia, so, you know, it's obviously become an ideological training facility. It's essentially a seminary for wokeness at this point, which, you know, historically, I think you can see this as an almost inevitable development of or consequence of sort of like two simultaneous trends that happened in the last half of the 20th century. So, you know, first you had the vast growth in the size of the student body. So, you know, before about the 1950s, the only people who would go to university would be either the children of the elite or working class kids on a full ride scholarship because they were just that smart, right? And overall, you're sort of biasing your sample towards the far right of the IQ distribution. So these are going to be people who are, you know, they're smart. They're probably a little bit harder to trick because they're actually genuinely smart. And they can handle very intellectually rigorous work. Then, after World War II, particularly as the 1960s and 70s get rolling, you start bringing in much, much larger fractions of the population. I mean, by the time you get to the 1990s, it's like half the population, basically, are attending higher education of some sort. Well, you're now sampling the entire bell curve, more or less, at this point. So, you know, instead of having like a student body whose average IQ is like, you know, 115, 120, it's like an average IQ of 102, if you're lucky. So, okay, what do you do with all of the midwits that you're bringing in and that you're bilking for money, right? Well, you can't put them in physics or engineering or medicine, at least not initially, because the bridges will fall down, physics is too intrinsically difficult, and patients will die, right? So you put them into the soft disciplines, into the arts and the humanities, and you just dumb those down. You have to dumb those down, because they're just not smart enough to handle the difficult work. That, in turn, sort of created... it created a population that were sort of a captive population who were relatively easily indoctrinated because they weren't that smart. And they were in disciplines that were intrinsically very easy to make ideological. So, you know, what happens? All of the communists start glomming onto those disciplines. Very quickly, your English departments, your history departments, they start filling up with activist professors who see their see their purpose as to start the revolution, to awaken the consciences of their young charges. This kind of, you know, Paulo Freire pedagogy of the oppressed way of looking at things. Now, at the same time, the growth of the managerial enterprise throughout all parts of society meant that inside the university system, you had this rapid growth of the administrative caste, who, you know, initially they were basically just supposed to do the paperwork and enable the professors to, you know, pursue their very important research, teaching, what have you. But inevitably, they started essentially sort of grabbing, you know, essentially all power within the university because they're in charge of all the administrative decisions. Duh. When you get to the modern context, okay, so you end up with these not just humanities departments, but also all the grievance departments, you know, black studies, women's studies, gender studies, etc., that were made in order to, you know, first of all, soak up the dumb students, but second of all, also sort of were started up by the activist professors after they'd already suborned the humanities departments. And they have these kind of power centers. They're in an alliance with the administrative caste inside the universities, in order to sort of control the environment, essentially. And what we've seen happen in the last decade or so has been almost like kind of like a mopping up operation, where the remaining power center that hadn't been ideologically captured was essentially the STEM departments. Because there was no intrinsic ideological, obviously ideological element to mathematics, for example, or chemistry. Maybe in the application of it, but certainly not in the study of it. So they managed to keep the ideology out of those departments and maintain relatively high academic standards until very recently. And then they started going after them at the level of admissions and hiring, essentially like, oh, you know, you don't need to start teaching gay race communism, but you do need to follow the gay race communist principles of having a diverse student body and a diverse faculty composition. And that sort of brings you to where the university is today, actually.
And the thing is, the thing is that the presence of those students in those on those courses, in those departments, kind of subverts the... I'm going to be careful how I word this, but it leads the way to those departments becoming subverted. Because, for example, if you've got lots of female students, then you've got to lower the standards. And you've got to demonize the white male standards that these poor girls are being subjected to. Same thing with the non-white students. They can then launch campaigns against the sort of Western Eurocentric tone of the syllabus and the curriculum.
Right. Yeah, and that started to manifest in a number of subtle and not so subtle ways. For example, you're not supposed to talk about Newton's laws anymore. You're supposed to talk about the laws of motion, right? So there's been this kind of effort to remove the name,
decolonize
the white man's science, and like that. Actually, decolonization has become like an increasingly big thing in Canadian academia. Indigenization, we'll call it sometimes as well. It's indigenous science, and it's like
thing even in Scottish education. I've heard about teachers talking about decolonizing the Scottish curriculum,
which is insane. This is one of the. So when I was living in Sweden years ago, I saw you speak live at an event in Stockholm back in like 2017 or something. I remember it being a very good speech. I remember being told by the Swedes that they had to feel very bad about imperialism and colonialism because during when the slave ships were still operating, it was possible. No one had proof, but it was possible, maybe even likely, that some iron from Swedish mines had been used for some of the like chains on some of the slave ships. Just given, the nature of a fungible commodity in a global economy, right? And like this was like their go-to explanation for therefore infinite brown people from the Middle East. And what just amazed me about that, I mean, it was just incredibly contrived, right? But since then, I've noticed that every single Western country has some kind of narrative which is used by the local power structure to explain to people, therefore, infinite brown people. And, like, the goal or the conclusion of the argument of therefore mass immigration is never in doubt. Like, it always arrives there, right? Like, in Ireland is, I think, one of the best examples of this, actually, where it's like, well, you know, you need to let them all in because you were colonized too, and you need to show solidarity with the people who are going to replace you, actually.
I'll tell you what's really interesting about that argument. First of all, it's saying, well, you didn't do anything bad. You didn't colonize other people or whatever, but you did move. You did emigrate. Therefore, you can't blame people for emigrating to your homeland.
Right.
But the second thing that's more interesting is, well, it's the Irish people who are still in Ireland are the ones who didn't emigrate.
Right. Yes.
So it's absurd. It's a lie.
It's like you are genetically related to people who at some point in the past emigrated, even though your direct ancestors obviously did not. So yeah, we're going to punish you for the things that your distant cousins did, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then the third reason it's interesting is that it's inherently recognizing the existence of the Irish people, because right. the ones who remain didn't emigrate, and yet you're punishing them or likening them to the ones who did. Well, then you must believe in the existence of the Irish people in order to do that. Otherwise, what you're right. saying doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So it's right. actually inherently ethnocentric in a way.
Yes. They do this all the time. You know, they'll argue that there's no such thing as the Anglo-Saxons when, you know, you want to defend the interest of Anglo-Saxons, but, you know, the moment it's time to say sorry for something an Anglo-Saxon did in the past, suddenly everyone knows what an Anglo-Saxon is, you know, and like, it's, oh, yeah. you know, like, there's so many examples of this kind
Another
of thing.
Example and, of this is within Germany, nobody expects Turkish children at school to feel guilty about the Holocaust. But in another context, they'll say that those Turkish children are as German as anyone else.
Right.
Well, clearly they're
right.
not.
Right. So
again, it's inherently recognizing the reality of ethnos, race, kin, you know, all of that.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, it's always predicated ultimately on a hostility to the local population, which has been earmarked for dispossession and replacement. That's what it always comes down to in every single country. And this is the point that I've made, you know, many times, in my writings on this particular subject, because I find that, dissidents and nationalists, and even people who aren't yet that sort of radicalized, but still, you know, might have a few problems with how things are being done, very often have somewhat of a parochial outlook where, you know, they're aware of the problems in their own country and the absurdities of some of the arguments that are used by their own local ruling class. But they don't see the full context, how these similar arguments are being used in all sorts of different countries as similar policies are being being pursued. Once you sort of like step back and you, like, you look at this across the full range, you're like, wait, like this unity of policy across all these countries, all these sort of justified using arguments tailor-made for each local population, sort of suggests that the arguments are all bullshit, actually. So, you know, this is a useful thing to realize, because then once you realize the arguments are nonsense, you don't need to make that argument anymore, right? So this is kind of the issue, is that people will get tied up. And I feel like the alt-right, the dissident right, whatever, spent a very large part of the last decade, you know, particularly in like sort of 2015, 2016 era, sort of grappling with these arguments and trying to disassemble them and or deconstruct them or whatever, you know, pointing out all the logical flaws. And that was necessary work, but at the same time, it's very possible to kind of get lost in that, because that's all just being thrown up by the enemy as chaff, you know, it's like camouflage. It's just there to kind of confuse you and disorient you. And even if you're sort of arguing with it, you're still using your energy to argue with it instead of actually doing something directly about the problem. But once you realize that, like, none of these arguments can be made in good faith, you can sort of put all that aside and be like, okay, these people are just the enemy. I don't need to listen to anything they say. Like, they open their mouths, they're lying, it's not in their best interests. Like, just ignore everything they say, except insofar as it can be used against them tactically. And just focus on removing them. Like,
yeah.
You know, like this.
I think this is a thing that happens with people who are older generations who aren't so plugged into the internet. They'll hear these arguments, like an older Swedish guy will hear this argument about Sweden. And because he's not plugged into the online scene, he won't realize that similar arguments are being made in Norway, in Canada, in Scotland, England, Italy, everywhere. So he takes it on good faith. Like he takes it at face value. He thinks, okay, this is a genuine argument. Well, it's silly. It's clearly stupid. So I've got to deal with it. And as you say, once you see the international situation, you realize that all of this is just squidding. It's nonsense. If it were that argument, they'd be using some other argument.
That is exactly. I've been using that metaphor for years now. Like, language is supposed to be, it's for communication. You're supposed to use it to clarify things. But there is a type of person who uses words like a squid squirts ink. You know, like, and that's, they've always been around, you know, like sociopaths and so on. Like, this is, they've always been part of the human societal matrix. But, you know, they're the ones running things right now, actually. And the only value I can find in listening to anything they say is just to try and puzzle out, okay, what are they signaling to each other that they're going to do next? Right? Like, because they kind of have to do that in the open. And they usually are pretty, so, you know, they coordinate by sending signals through their own public communications. So if you pay attention to that, you go, okay, this is the next step, you know, this is what they're going to do next. And that can be useful. But engaging with your arguments, pointless. And I think you're completely correct with the generational divide there. I find, a lot of the sort of red pill boomers, for example, are the ones who will get, like, they'll get angry about, like, how dare they lie like this? Like, this makes no sense. Like, how could they say that, you know? But, like, the younger people, like, I guess maybe, like, you know, we've grown up in an environment where we just expect that they're going to lie. So we don't even get angry about it. They're like, well, of course they're lying. That's just what they do. Like,
yeah, you know, but also, I think we're more, I don't want to do down the boomers here or praise our own generation, but I think that we grew up more with the internet and therefore more open to, more aware that things are global now. So,
yes,
when something appears to be confined to a particular country, it might be, or it might really not be. And I think we are more aware of that than the boomer who tends to think that, well, this is happening here, therefore it must be happening because of something here.
Right.
I've seen that now and then with people of a certain age, that they think something is specific to this country because it's happening, because they see it happening in this country. It's understandable. I mean, this isn't a criticism of them. I just think it's natural that they're going to be like that. But in this day and age, it's quite naive to think that anything is particular to one country.
I mean, it's been naive, I think, for quite some time now. To a large degree, I think a lot of this is driven by technology. You know, ever since the Second World War, and we always talk about the post-war consensus, you know, but I think something that often gets overlooked when we're discussing the political developments following World War II is how the technological environment went through an absolute, you know, sea change. So not only did you have the proliferation of electronic media, and telecommunications infrastructure, and so on, you also had international jet travel that could take you from, you know, one continent to the other side of the world in 12 hours. So,
yeah.
Back in the 1950s, easy access to this was really kind of, this was an upper class phenomenon. We used to talk about, like, jet setters, you know, like you're the jet set, like you're one of those rich people who goes to France for their summer vacation. You know, like, most people didn't do that. You know, back then you had long distance telephone charges. I mean, I think technically they still have those, but, like, who the hell would call someone long distance on a phone? Like, that's insane. Like, right? Like, so, like, but if you were in the upper class back in the 1950s, 1960s, you were already part of this global culture. And the local peoples that you were ruling over were not. They were still very much part of these sort of parochial national cultures. So basically, the upper class, the ruling class, they became the first, the world's first network state, kind of quietly. You know, they all sort of started identifying as citizens of the world, as part of this new tribe that sees themselves as being like the custodians of all humanity, who are more concerned with the poverty experienced by, you know, Congolese orphans than they are with the poverty experienced by the comparatively well-off poor of their own countries, because they're like, well, on an absolute global scale, like that Congolese orphan is much worse off. So, you know, poor working class person at home, shut up, you got it relatively good. I'm still going to take your money and give it to them. But they maintained like a pretense until fairly recently of being the national representatives, local national representatives. And they still kind of go through the motions of that, but I think at this point, very few people believe yeah. them anymore, because it's so obvious that they're all just kind of part of their own tribe. And this is actually, remember, like, there was a couple of years ago, there's a woman at the World Economic Forum, and she was recorded saying something like how wonderful it is that, you know, Davos and other organizations like that are bringing together the world's elite, and because of this, you know, they're able to coordinate better and they trust each other more and more. But the closer they get and the more they trust one another, the less their people at home trust them. And, you know, this is really confusing to her. And I remember seeing that and being like, you're an idiot. Like, of course, because we were looking at you, we're all looking at you, we're all thinking, well, you're a different tribe now. And you're not representing us. You're not you're the leadership of our tribe. You're like this other tribe, which is sort of dominating us, actually, which then sort of puts us all in the situation of being in these kind of like national liberation movements.
When I think about Justin Trudeau, because you were talking about they hid it for a long time, but more recently it's become very obvious. Mm-hmm. When I think about Justin Trudeau, David Cameron, Nick Clegg, that's 14 years ago that they became the Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister in Britain. 14 years ago. When I think about them, that generation, who are still in power now, I mean, they're still at the top of the peak of their game. That, I would say, that was probably the first time when you could say these people are, if anything, they're as plugged into the global scene as they are to their national, their own home nation. And then when you get to Keir Starmer, he just says it. He says he identifies more with Davos than with Westminster, because and that's where things happen.
Justin Trudeau, and he's like, well, Canada's a post-national state that has no core identity, you know, like, because that's sort of his vision. You know, he's part of the people who have that vision for the world. The entire world is an airport lounge. Starmer coming out and saying that wasn't even that surprising, actually. You know, we all know they think that way. But I think they also maybe, now that they've had a couple decades of mass immigration, you know, the last decade especially, where they've really jammed them in, so they probably think, okay, we've got like lots of clients we've imported who see it that way, and there are a ton of people inside the professional managerial class who also, you know, because air travel has gotten cheaper and the internet and so on, they have email jobs, they travel around a lot, you know, they're all anywheres instead of somewheres now, so they also kind of see it that way. And you know, I guess I'm kind of a class traitor, actually, because, you know, I've spent most of my adult life living outside Canada, various different countries abroad. You know, I travel a lot. You know, I've had an email job for quite some time. You know, the only calluses on my hands are from lifting weights, but not from, like, you know, doing construction work or whatever. So I kind of see where they're coming from, but of course the problem is they're sort of absolutists about it. So it's like large cities historically have very often been quite cosmopolitan. Like that's not like a recent development. You know, you can find all sorts of cities in ancient Egypt where you'd have like the Greek quarter and, you know, the Jewish quarter and so on. Like this is not new. What's new is this idea that the entire world has to become like that. And the problem there is that you just make everything homogeneous. You lose all sort of like local culture, local color. You centralize everything to an unhealthy degree. And this is going to cause a lot, and it is causing a lot of conflict. Now, at the same time, you know, we're not going to get rid of the internet. We're not going to get rid of international jet travel. And in fact, that problem is probably going to get worse. If SpaceX is successful with its long-term and medium-term plans for the capabilities of Starship, now, they want to be providing Earth-to-Earth transport on Starship for prices competitive with those of an airline, but with 90 minutes point-to-point, any two points on the surface of the Earth. You know, like a duration equivalent to a long bus ride to get from Beijing to Boston, right? As that capability builds up, you know, towards the end of the century, like it seems incredible to talk about this now, right? But this could just be like how people travel by the end of the 21st century. So, you know, forget about being 12 hours from Mumbai or whatever. Like, no, you'll be like an hour away. So like this technological capability to move huge numbers of people around in very short periods of time is probably, you know, if civilization doesn't collapse, it's just going to become even more of an issue. And we need to think about, okay, like, how do we preserve national cultures in that kind of environment? And you can't just say, okay, we're going to become North Korea and like shut out the world, right? But you also can't say, okay, we're going to have open borders and everyone could just flood in. Because both of these will lead to some kind of collapse. You have to maintain a certain degree of openness, like any thermodynamic system has to be open, but so it doesn't choke on its own entropy. But you also need to control your cell membrane, right, in order to maintain like internal homeostasis. And the Anywheres, the cosmopolitans, the Keir Starmers and Justin Trudeau's of this world and the people who support them, like they just want the entire world to be one big airport lunch. And they need to, there needs to be some kind of compromise. Like, you know, for instance, you might say, okay, the big cities, we're going to let the big cities be cosmopolitan, but outside of defined urban zones, the passport requirements get much stricter. Something like that, for example. Like you need like a DNA passport to reside yeah. outside of London, but I mean, London itself is like its own thing. You know,
I've got to say, I wouldn't even go for that. Even that wouldn't be tough enough for me because London, you know, I don't know if you've seen it recently, but it's the same with Amsterdam. It's the same with Paris. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess you could say, well, if we just give up these cities and just say, okay, that London is no longer effectively part of England, so therefore it's no longer an English city. We no longer expect it to be that. Total divorce, really, disavow kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then that's yeah, sure. You could then have London. You just give it over to the global. Just give it over to globalism. But if you want it to remain English in any way, then then this. I think this diversity has to be reversed. I mean, otherwise, it's just not going to be English.
I think a lot of the conflict around this stuff, I mean, there's multiple sources to it. You know, one is like we've been importing incredibly low quality people. You know, like the UK especially, it's like the people you've been bringing in from the Middle East and Pakistan. Like, my God, what are you thinking? That's one part of it. I think another huge part of it that young white men are excruciatingly painfully aware of, and everyone else has largely refused to acknowledge, is that doing this sort of required holding our arms behind our back as we get beaten. You know, it's like, you know, in order to achieve equity in hiring, for example, the white guys get screwed so the others can move to the head of the line. So, you know, we kind of experience this like second class citizenship status in our own countries increasingly. Take that away. Get rid of all the civil rights nonsense where you can't just discriminate in hiring. You can't discriminate in terms of having like neighborhood covenants, for example. Bring back freedom of association. And I think that would actually take care of a lot of it, because then your cities could simply self-organize and would rapidly self-organize into sort of like ethnic enclaves. Like, okay, like, you know, this part of London is now like little Saudi Arabia, and if you're white, just don't go there, because like they basically have Sharia there. But, you know, this other part of London is London. Like, it's like, you know, British London. And if you try to do your Sharia shit there, like, those boys with the St. George's crosses tattooed on their foreheads are going to kick the tar out of you, you know? Like, maybe not the foreheads. I'm going to go a little too far. We don't want English MS-13 here.
I understand what you're saying.
I'm sort of like, and like, okay, what do we gain from that? Right? Like, what would be the point? Why would we want to give them any territory at all? It would only work if the rest of the world was following a similar principle, right? So there would also need to be sort of English enclaves and French enclaves, what have you, American enclaves in like Mumbai and Beijing and so on. This kind of, so each civilization essentially maintaining a kind of network state diaspora throughout the cosmopoles around the world. And then in exchange for that sort of ability to maintain that global presence yourself, you sort of say, okay, well, you know, we also allow like our own local cosmopoles to sort of be similarly arranged, right? But then outside of those areas, it's like, no, here, this is our actual territory, and
yeah,
you're not allowed there, you know? Like, you can come as a tourist, but you can't live here. Or like it's, you know, there's certainly no subsidies for it, right? This, I think, would be like an overall healthier way of that happening. Yeah, that's not what's happening now. What's happening now is it's literally just our countries that are doing this. It's being massively subsidized by our own governments. It's being done in such a way that our own birth rate is suppressed for, you know, replacing us in our own countries and so on. This is not okay. And I do think that before a sort of more rational Neal Stephenson Diamond Age network state settlement of that sort could evolve, I think, you know, things are probably going to get pretty rough in the next 10, 15 years in the Western world, because I don't think people are going to put up with this for much longer. And at the same time, I don't see the regime quietly moving aside. Like, they're really committed to this. So, like,
yeah, it's interesting times ahead for sure. I mean, because as you say, there aren't that many places to white flight to at this point.
There aren't.
governments are trying to make sure that there are no places that you can buy. I mean, and really, it's pretty much there now. I mean, I dare say there's a village somewhere in England that is still, you know, English, wholly English. But I mean, it's
well, even here in Canada now, like I'm in a small village at the moment, you know, a few thousand people, and like even here, you know, like they're starting to come in, and I've noticed just the last few years, like that the number of them has increased noticeably. And friends of mine elsewhere in the country and similar small municipalities report the same. And this is deliberate Canadian government policy where they're deliberately trying to push the new arrivals to take jobs and residency and outlying rural areas, just like you're doing in London or in England. And Sweden has been pursuing a similar policy. Ireland, you know, we've all seen the videos of the migrant centers with literal barracks, you know, being like built all over the island in these small villages. So yeah, they want to make it so that there is nowhere to escape to. But I think that's, personally, I think that's because of the people who are in charge of this are actively trying to wipe out our civilization. As some kind of like long-term Fabian socialist plan, like managerialist plan to like, you know, usher in the brave new world by completely disrupting everything that came before, subverting it, tearing up the traditions, overwriting it with like new top-down systems. And they're using population movement, large-scale population movement enabled by the technological capabilities of rapid mechanical travel in order to facilitate that.
Oh, I agree. And it's a program. It's the Kalergi program. It's I think it's completely deliberate. I don't know how anyone can say to themselves at this point that it's just some sort of accident. I mean, how could it possibly be? But yeah, I think there's obviously a conflict coming here. Disclaimer here, I'm not advocating a damn thing. I'm just predicting. And people always got, Enoch Powell complained that he was accused of wanting chaos because he predicted chaos.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a problem forever. The people who warn about this get accused of ginning it up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want trouble, but I certainly predict trouble. I think there is conflict coming in a massive, massive way.
I don't even think you need to predict it. Like I think it's already started. Frankly, we had a couple of pieces over the last year. One almost exactly a year ago, actually, was when the Dublin riots happened in response to that little girl getting stabbed by a migrant. And the Irish just cooked off and started torching migrant buses and reception centers and so on. And, you know, and I watched that and I was like, okay, that's interesting. That's very interesting. So this is the first time, I think that was the first time anywhere in Europe or anything on that scale had happened. And at the time I was like, okay, like this is how it begins. It's not how it ends. Ireland is still screwed. And sure enough, like the Irish state has doubled down, triple down, you know, crack down on the protesters, hate speech legislation, brought in even more migrants, settled them all throughout the country. And there's been kind of sporadic resistance against that, which has been smashed flat. Not surprising, it's the Irish. The Irish have never, Irish resistance has not historically been terribly, it's been enthusiastic, but not logistically well planned. That's not really their strength as a people. No offense to any Irish listeners, but you know it's true. And then, you know, a few months later, in August, it jumps to the UK.
Just to intervene. Uh-huh. The thing, what you said there is correct, but it's true of everywhere, because the amateurs are never as good at organizing as the government, the state, because they've got the trained professionals to organize. So, yeah, the Irish protesters were disorganized, but then the Irish state was bloody well, was well organized.
It's true. The Continentals, I think, political change in the continent usually, like, not leaving France aside, because France will just have like some giant revolution and kill everyone in power. The Germans are much more systematic in how they go about things. They're like lemmings, I guess you could say. They're kind of like a consensus society. So are the Swedes, for that matter. And I found it actually, because when I was living in Sweden, I would always like tell my Swedish friends there, is like, because you know they're all extremely black-pilled, because you know it's Sweden, right? It's the gayest country in the world. They're like, oh no, like there's no hope for Sweden. Like they're so propagandized, they're so lost. Like you know, it's, everything's done here. And I was like, you guys just watch, because you're a consensus society, and the way consensus societies work is that you have like you have very little debate happening on the surface, because debate isn't really tolerated in a consensus society. You're supposed to just kind of like, you know, go with the flow. But there's a kind of subsurface debate which is happening, where people are always kind of like feeling out like what is the consensus right now. You know, what is unspoken is often as important as what's spoken. And then you'll have these events that happen every, you know, generation or two, where you have an abrupt shift in the consensus, and it happens practically overnight. And everyone in that society will just kind of like hop from the old consensus to the new consensus without breaking stride. And suddenly there's a new program. And you can see this in Swedish history having happened, you know, multiple times, where they would sort of go from like, oh, we're a very, very Christian country, to, no, actually, we're doing nationalism now, to, oh, actually, we're doing racial nationalism now, to, oh, no, actually, we're doing social democracy now, without really any upheaval. Like, no one got killed. But the whole society would just kind of, like, coordinate itself in a new direction. And to me, it's been obvious for a long time that the Scandinavians are, that's what, they're just going to, like, sort of have a, something's going to go click in their heads collectively at some point, I think in the near future. And they're just going to be like, all right, they all need to get out now, and we don't care how that happens. And you can sort of see that switch happening now in the Scandinavian countries, I think. Again, like no big protests or riots or anything like that, because that's not really their way. And I think the Germans, it's going to be kind of similar. But they'll be the Germans, for historical reasons, the hangover from World War II, will be the absolute last of the Europeans to sort of remember themselves again, I think. I think France, as always, is going to be an absolute mess. England is the one I'm really worried about, though. Britain, it's... I think Britain is in a worse state than anywhere else in on the planet, in Europe or the European diaspora.
Well, is that because it's so under the thumb of America or something else?
Partly it's the American influence, but a lot of it's homegrown. The British elite have been quietly hostile towards Britain itself for some generations now. You know, you've got the old Tory elite who just want to suck it dry, and have basically very little in the way of genuine, deeply held feeling for the people, for the nation, for the land. Aside from, you know, aesthetics that they throw at different gamins. And then on the other side, you have your kind of like, you know, managerialist, socialist, liberal, democrat, corporatist types who just see everything traditional or old-fashioned or British as being kind of an obstacle in need of being reformed or removed or annihilated. And there really isn't anyone on the national political scene who strikes me as being fundamentally opposed to all that or fundamentally in favor of something more positive. The closest you have is Nigel Farage, and he's a bit weak sauce, honestly. In that, you have just kind of a general economic malaise that the country has dealt with for a very long time now. All of your rights have been taken away from you. Like every single last of one of the old Anglo-Saxon freedoms has been systematically stripped. Culture is atomized, packed full of hostile foreigners who are given every advantage and protection by the state. It's just a very, very, I mean, I don't think it's hopeless by any means. Like, I'm not like a black pillar. I never black pill. But it's just a grim situation, which is going to, it's a deep hole that's going to take a lot of climbing to get out of, I think. Although I do think it's, I do sort of hold out some degree of hope for mutual aid, because just the same way that the kind of globalists all cooperate internationally with one another, we all need to sort of learn to do the same thing. Instead of letting each country kind of like fight its own individual local battles, like there needs to be, I think, more thought given to how do we. I'm thinking out loud here, so if what I'm about to say sounds stupid, I apologize. But, strategically identify weak points in the system and then exploit those weak points by concentrating forces there in order to cause fractures inside of the global control system at local fracture points. And then sort of like, you know, systematically move from like one spot to the next spot to the next spot. And I think we're already kind of doing that at like an electronic media level, just given our ability to like kind of like focus attention on this or that spot. Like, you know, as an example, in the case of the UK, when the riots were happening, and of course the government was, you know, going after everyone they could, and everyone in the UK, all the dissidents in the UK were really watching what they said, because y'all knew like exactly, you know, how much trouble you could get into if you said something even slightly wrong. But at the same time, you had all of the dissidents in the entire rest of the world acting as like a force multiplier, kind of like, you know, coming in, mobbing, you know, the British government. And like, you know, and this ultimately is words on the internet, but it does have something of a psychic impact. I'm just wondering if that could be scaled up to something more.
I agree. Yeah. However, it's a question of organization and having an infrastructure there that people.
And that does not exist right now.
No, it doesn't. It's too informal. And again, this is the kind of thing that the left did a long time ago.
Yeah,
they've got it all in place.
Yeah,
which is not.
You look at the way, like, you know, the Spanish Civil War, right, where they brought in like all of these foreign battalions to help the Republicans, right? Which, and they ultimately lost the war, thank God. But as an example of that kind of thing, where it's like, oh, the regime in this country is having a rough time of it. How do we get a lot of troublemakers there from various other countries to give them a rougher time of it and, you know, maybe tip it over? I realize what I'm saying is going to be a little bit dangerous, actually.
No. I don't think so, because you're not advocating violence or sedition, whatever, so it's fine.
I'm talking about open source color revolutions.
Well, you know, yes, but
basically, which does not necessarily involve violence. You don't even need to be breaking the law. That was actually a key thing in a lot of the color revolution playbook. Is like they're not, you know, you avoid breaking the law, so you don't give the other side an excuse to arrest you.
Exactly. Well, I think that this kind of thing is inevitable, and I think it only is inevitable because we people from these different countries, like you and me right now, keep talking to each other. This is again another reason why we should do this kind of thing, because it keeps us aware of each other's situation, and it keeps us connected and concerned for these different countries. So I think it's very important, because when Canada implements some kind of law that against you can't talk about the truckers, well, we in Britain can talk about the truckers. But this sort of thing, that's just an example off the top of my head. And then with Britain, when the state says that you can't name this person who's killed someone or whatever, you can't say this or that, people in other countries can do it. This is just what the left did, you know, this kind of tactic. So I don't think it's illegal what we're saying here. I think we're just observing what will naturally happen.
Although it's worth keeping in mind that the system itself is increasingly less bothered about whether or not their opponents are actually breaking any laws. Their hold on power is actually getting more tenuous over time, and they're having to resort to increasingly naked use of hard power in order to hold on.
Well, I think we saw this with the riots. I mean, in July. It's a situation that has become so intolerable that, surprise, surprise, some people complain about it and riot and protest and whatever. Then the government has to crack down on that, but in doing so, it's saying you don't have the right to protest about this thing which is intolerable.
You don't even have the right to complain about it. Forget about taking to the streets. If you say something on the internet, we are going to put you in jail. Like, it's, you know, but we're not going to put those other people in jail if they, you know, have their way with your daughter, for example. Like, which, you know, that which of course, like, actually just exacerbates the situation, right? I mean, like, they a large part of the psychological strategy is this kind of, you know, they want the helots to learn their place, like, you know, humiliation rituals, and, like, you know, grind their faces into the dirt, like, make them feel like, well, like helots, right? Like second class citizens, and make them believe that resistance is futile, essentially. Make them lose all respect for themselves, and then they'll let themselves be kicked. Problem is, if they are not quite successful in doing that, it actually just gets people's blood up eventually. And you know, the longer that goes on, and even the actual helots in Sparta, like, the Spartans kept them down for several hundred years, but in the end, the helots broke free. That kind of thing it never works in the long run. And the longer it goes on, the deeper the resentment becomes.
For sure.
Yeah. It's I think that also is one of the reasons why the regime is increasingly brutal. Because you know, the only data that we have to go on, really, is, you know, whatever public polling data that is actually reliable that we are able to get our hands on that gets published, you know, or, you know, just what we observe from talking to people or taking the temperature from the online discourse. And of course, you know, all of these are fraught with their own sources of confirmation bias and sample bias and so on. The regime, I'm sure, has far superior data in terms of, like, you know, reading public sentiment. And I suspect their internal data is, if we were able to see that, we'd probably realize that, like, there's a lot more people who agree with us, and people are a lot angrier, actually, than is let on. You know, here in Canada, about a year ago, there was a leaked RCMP internal, like, study, like prospectus that had been put together, where basically the Mounties are, you know, quietly informing the Canadian government that Canada is pre-revolutionary right now, and we're actually really worried about being able to keep a lid on things because, like, the Canadian people are getting so angry that we're concerned they're going to start killing people, actually. Like, politicians are going to, you know, like, and I, you know, when I saw that, I was, like, kind of surprised, actually. I was like, really? Like, you know, Canadians are pissed, and there's, you know, F. Trudeau signs all over the country, and every other normie I talk to starts Fed posting the moment you bring up Trudeau. But you still wouldn't quite know that from just, like, walking down the street. But their own internal data seems to suggest that the country is, like, at this, like, simmering point of resentment that could explode at any moment, and they don't think they can keep a handle on it if it does.
Well, this is absolutely. I can believe that because it's like people, a great percentage of people won't do anything, but yeah. If something happens, they'll approve of it and won't do anything to help prevent.
Right, right. Or it's like it's like a far from equilibrium thermodynamic system, like. Avalanche mathematics, right? Like sandpile model. So you drop some sand down, you drop another grain of sand, pile builds up, and then one of those grains of sand is going to cause an avalanche on the sand pile. Exactly which one will do it, you have no idea. Until it comes down, the pile is sort of metastable. Like none of those all those sand grains are sort of stationary. We're not doing anything. But then that little disturbance caused by that single sand grain coming down is able to precipitate a cascade of motion through the system. You see this kind of thing all through physics, where you have these systems that are kind of like metastable until a perturbation causes it to like suddenly reorganize itself.
Is this chaos theory?
It is related. Yes, yes, yes. This is sort of a part of chaos theory. Element, aspect of thermodynamics as well. Social systems tend to work in a very similar way, where, you know, everyone's kind of going along, whatever, no one's individually going to do something, and then you have some kind of inciting incident that suddenly just like unleashes all of this energy that's been pent up and everything starts reorganizing. You know, the fall of the Soviet Union and the various Warsaw Pact republics at the end of the 1980s kind of followed this model, actually, where you had these populations that were just immiserated, they hated the regime, but no one was doing anything sort of individually because, you know, you got your Stasi or, you know, whatever, like the consequences of doing something yourself are so severe that like you're not even going to say anything except maybe to a close friend after, you know, looking both ways to make sure no one's listening. But then suddenly something would happen, and you get this like preference cascade through the population as everyone realizes, like, wait, I'm not alone in this, actually. And like, there's so many of us that hate this, and we're just done with it. And we're just done with this now. And then at that point, like, boom, regime's fallen. Like, it just can't keep control anymore. Because, like, the herd has sort of, like, yep, you're not in charge anymore. You know? There's nothing they can do. And they can try to shoot some people. But then if the preference cascade ends up going through your troops, and your troops just refuse to shoot, like what happened to Ceausescu, and then you're really done, you know? When this whole system comes down, I think it's going to be something very, very sort of similar to that. We're not quite there yet, I think, because there's still so many people that are benefiting from this, sort of inside the professional managerial class, or are still quite thoroughly propagandized by it. But on the other hand, because of the ideology the system itself has adopted, of sort of deliberately excluding young native-born men from systems of power, they're actually like alienating the most militarily capable part of their own population, which I think will actually, I think that will actually accelerate their loss of political control. I had an essay on this, Universal Suffrage as a Suicide Pact, a couple of months ago, where I just kind of, I basically argued, like, okay, the essence of democracy is that instead of counting severed heads after a fight, or broken heads, you know, like you count, you just do a head count. Like, okay, we assume the bigger side would win the fight, so let's not have a fight, we'll just say the bigger side won. Like, that's basically what democracy comes down to. But what happens when all of the people on one side, which might lose the vote, might lose the headcount, but all of your dangerous guys, all your violence-capable males, are all on one side of an issue? Well, I mean, maybe they'll go along with it, but they can also kind of look at each other and be like, well, wait a minute, if we decided to make an issue of this, what would the other side be able to do? And the answer would be nothing, actually, because they have virtually no capability to exercise force. And at that point, you don't even need to use force because it's over before it starts. You know, you just kind of win, fait accompli.
So a lot of people in our movement are very black-pilled, and they tend to think that the system is so powerful, so resourceful, so advanced and sophisticated, that it's going to roll on for a long time, like a long, long time, until some black swan or an invading civilization from afar comes in and intervenes and messes it all up.
Right.
There is also a meme in our community recently, nothing ever happens. So whenever you think something's going to happen and then it turns out to be a big letdown, like Trump 2016,
Matt
Pild was saying that it's going to be the same this time. So nothing
or
ever
Greg,
happens.
Or Brexit. Or every time it looks like the Third World War is going to start, or it looks like the economy is going to collapse, it's like, oh, nothing ever happened. I know, that's a fun meme. I always just like to say 2020 to people, because, like, you know, March 2020, did nothing ever happen, really, like, during those 2 years? Like, let's be real here.
But that's the regime enforcing things, not... But when people say nothing ever happens, what they mean is the regime is never damaged.
Yeah, I think part of that comes from the sort of... It almost seems kind of immature for me, like you're saying, well, why don't they just crumble the first time we do something? It's like, that's not how it works. Like, you're not just going to be like, well, okay, you expressed your discontent with this, we're going to go home now. Like, no, like, these are people who want to wipe you out, who want to destroy your civilization. They've been at it for 100 years now. Like, they're not just going to, like, give up because there's been a bit of, like, popular pushback. Like, good God. Like, no, like, it's gonna take a while. On the other hand, people were saying exactly the same thing, both internally and externally, about the Soviet Union all through the 1980s. No one thought it was going to fall apart at the end of the 80s. When I say no one, I don't literally mean no one. There were a very small number of analysts who were predicting this, who were vindicated later on, and everyone thought they were insane. The sort of received wisdom in that period was that the Soviet Union would grind on for decades, if not generations, into the future. That it was its power, its internal power, was so totalizing that there was just no way of stopping it. But the truth was that it was completely demoralized internally. The people hated it, but its own elite didn't believe any of their own bullshit either. There were very few true believer communists by the 1980s. It had become very cynical. If you look at our own regime, it's the same. There are actually very few true believers. There are some. Most of them are actually very cynical about it. And so there's that. You have the widespread disillusionment amongst the people. It's also worth pointing out that when the Soviet Union just fell apart...
Hold that thought, because I just want to say here that I would have thought Justin Trudeau was a true believer until Trump gets in, and now he's saying that mass immigration has been a mistake.
You know, he's an actor.
Yeah.
He's literally an actor.
Yeah.
He's a drama instructor before he was a politician.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, like, that said, like, his father was an actual communist agent. So, like, you know, I'm sure there's an element of, you know, he was kind of brought up in this context.
Yeah.
But I think these are mostly very cynical people. People also, I think, when they look at the fall of the Soviet Union, because it did happen so abruptly, and from the outside, it sort of felt like, oh, there is this spontaneous uprising of the people that came out of absolutely nowhere, and, you know, a week later, they brought down these regimes all over the continent. But that's not what happened at all, actually. There was, like, a good decade of constant political agitation. You know, the Polish Solidarity Movement, protest movements all over Romania. There was this whole sort of, like, dissident subculture inside the Soviet Union where they were, like, you know, passing samizdat back and forth and, you know, going to, like, rock and roll shows at, like, illegal underground nightclubs and stuff. You know, all of this is going on for, like, a decade, but all sort of under the surface, all, like, very quiet, like, on and, like, you know, anyone who got caught participating in that, you know, they got sent to a gulag or disappeared into the prison system or whatever, you know, harshly sanctioned. I mean, does any of this sound familiar? Like, you know, I'm sure, like, if you were a Russian dissident or a Romanian dissident in, like, 1985, and you've been at it for, like, 10 years, like, you were probably pretty blackpilled, actually, because, like, you know, as far as you could tell, like, the regime hadn't cracked at all. Like, everything you'd done had been seemingly for, like, to no purpose. Like, maybe there were a couple more people hanging out in your scene than were around when you started. But beyond that, like, you know, like, the formal power of the regime was still there. And that situation persisted right up until it didn't. And suddenly when it cracked, because it's such a brittle system, very strong and very brittle, it just, like, shattered almost overnight. You know, whether that's going to be the fate of our own system or whether it proves to be, like, far more, like, flexible and adaptable, I think it may well be, actually, because it's not a literal communist totalitarian dictatorship. Our regime is... It is much more flexible. It does have the ability to, like, take a step back now and then. You look at the way that they're starting to throw the woke under the bus a little bit, right? So, like, you can tell that there's a sense amongst people in positions of power that, okay, you know, the plebs have been a bit too riled up by some of this stuff, so why don't we just kind of, we'll throw some of the worst offenders to the wolves, make a few cosmetic concessions, and maybe we'll let them like win an election, you know, here and there, and that'll quiet them down, and then we can just kind of continue as normal, like, after that. That's quite possible. And if, you know, they're smart enough to do that, like that, I think, probably extends the lifetime of the system quite a bit.
It depends how much of the ideology they can shed. Can they convincingly say, yeah, actually, I do like white people. I do think that Sweden should be basically white.
Exactly.
Get away with saying that, right, after the stuff they've said over the last 30 years. I don't know.
30 years, 80 years, 80 years. I mean, the post-war consensus, it's been, you know, like ever since the painter was defeated, it's, you know, you cannot say the word white people with a smile on your face. You're just not allowed to, you know. This was even the case back in the civil rights era. The 1950s, the 1950s and 60s. It's been going on for a long time. That's actually a very good question. Like, how much of the ideology can they shed? You know, you said before, you weren't sure how many of them are cynics and how many are true believers. This is actually a really good question, because there are true believers, and the true believers won't shed the ideology. Now, will the cynics toss all, will they be able to toss all the true believers to the wolves? Like, I don't know, man. Maybe, but there's a lot of true believers inside the system. And there are a lot of cynics too.
But if there are true believers, that make the more of them there are, the more brittle the system is.
And there's also, now that I think about it, actually, there's the Glasnost effect. So, like, you know, one of the things that actually did bring down the Soviet Union in at the end of the 1980s was precisely Gorbachev's Glasnost, his openness policy, where, you know, the Politburo, the Comintern, like, they kind of realized, like, oh, okay, like, we've been like a little bit too heavy-handed. We need to open things up a little bit, because, like, the heavy-handedness has caused a lot of resentment to a degree which is difficult to control. Okay, so we're gonna open things up, we're gonna liberalize just a little bit, you know. And the problem was, once they kind of removed those controls, like, the internal pressure that it built up just blew up the system. So, you know, okay, so like they try to put the woke away. Assuming they do, I haven't really seen too many indications that they're putting the woke away. What I've seen is indications that, like, some of the larger companies are actually running scared because their profits are on the line, because there's angry mobs coming for them. You know, but I haven't seen, like, the BBC or Hollywood, like, making based movies again. You know, like that's not happening.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's been a bit overstated. I do wonder, though, if it will change once Trump is in power. I remain open to the possibility that he is going to either deliberately or inadvertently cause cultural change in America. Well, we'll just have to wait and see.
Oh, I mean, I think he will cause cultural change. I mean, like, you know, he's already caused vast cultural change in the U.S. Like, you know, you compare America in 2024 to America in 2016. Like, it's a very different country. Say what you will, the right has become far more powerful and influential in America in the last 8 years. Talking points that were 4chan poll currency back in 2015 have been mainstream Republican talking points for like a couple of years now. Not all of them by any means. And like, they've been watered down. But, you know, like, they've been adopted at the same time. you know, we've been driving the culture to a very strong degree. And I've noticed, like, just like at an interpersonal level, that a lot of the kind of leftist types have been more muted and less strident in their personal interactions in the last couple of years. Last year, especially, in many cases, almost verging on apologetic, you know, like in the same way that like 10 years ago, you'd hear people say stuff like, well, I don't want to sound racist, but, and I don't actually hear people so often prefacing your remarks with, I don't want to sound racist, but I have started hearing people preface things with, like, well, I don't want to sound woke, but, you know, like they become like apologetic about the way that they advance their talking points because they're kind of on the back foot culturally. And a large part of this has been just Trump's presence and the galvanizing influence that he's had. Not so much like any actual policies that he's implemented or anything concrete like that, but that cultural influence is definitely there, which is, I think, that's the main reason they hate him so much. It's not so much what he's accomplished in office. It's more just like what he's accomplished as a symbol by sort of like polarizing public opinion, by giving white Americans for the first time in many generations a sort of tribal chieftain that they can rally behind and start to act as a cohesive group.
I agree. I think this is why they wanted to humiliate him and diminish him, have him banned from social media and all this.
The same reason they destroyed Enoch Powell back in the day.
Yeah.
Like,
because he was a symbol. It wasn't because they thought he was going to actually do anything. It was because his primary power, same with Brexit, the primary power of Brexit was not really the Britain leaving the EU. It was the its symbolic value as a rejection of that worldview. And I think Trump is the same thing, really.
Yes, that's exactly it. We told you how to vote. How dare you? How dare you not do what we told you to do? Like, it's, but of course, you know, Brexit itself ends up accomplishing almost nothing. But I think very important lessons have actually been learned in over the last 8 years because of Brexit and the aftermath of that, because of the sort of disappointing disaster of the first Trump presidency when he just got mired down by lawfare and all the rest of it. I think a lot of people now realize that politics is not a vote that you cast once every few years. This is sort of like the lie of representative democracy, that, like, you know, you participate in the political process by casting your little ballot once every few years, and you have your say, and then you go back to your little life. No, politics can only work if it is a continuous thing. You are always engaged in this. I mean, not literally always. You gotta sleep, you gotta shit, you know, you gotta eat, you gotta have fun in life, you gotta live your life still, but it's not something you ever get to, like, completely stop worrying about. And you need to be constantly pushing, constantly looking for, like, ways to advance your interests in small ways and in large ways, individually and collectively. Just like, you know, keeping an eye out for every opportunity that presents itself, and it's constantly pushing, which is what the left has done for generations now. And it's why the culture has kind of like moved in that left direction and not the opposite, because, like, you know, conservatives just like cast their vote and go home. I think that's ended now, because I think people have, like, sort of like realized, like, because we had these huge victories and then shit, nothing changed. Nothing ever happens, you know? It's like, well, yeah, because you all just went home. Like, you thought you'd fucking won. And one thing that I found reassuring with the 2024 election victory is that the sentiment I was seeing, I mean, everyone was obviously really happy that Trump won, but there was this kind of guarded, like, okay, well, like, that's good, but the fight's not over yet. In fact, it's actually just starting. Like, you know, it's this awareness that the election victory is almost more symbolic than anything else. So I think there's a maturity there that was not there in 2016.
Yeah, I think that people have become more cynical, much more cynical. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think that's the main reason for that is in America is the 2020 election, which was obviously stolen. Even left, after this recent one, 2024, you even saw leftists on Twitter saying, well, given the numbers here, maybe
where those 10 million votes go yeah, 15 yeah. million votes that we had last time. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we did steal it. Sherlock.
Although I also saw some of them being like trying to like advance the narrative that this one had been stolen somehow. And it's like, yeah, of course. Like, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in like January. Cause I know some people, Parvini, for example, have been saying, oh, yeah, there's not going to be any violence because the regime picked Trump, actually, this time. You know, elite theory maximalism. And we have others, Haywood, saying, just wait, it's coming. And I'm just like, well, you know, the last time we didn't get violence, actually, until, like, Inauguration Day. Like, you know, they're all still having a good cry. Well, yeah, I saw you're talking to Fortisax after this, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, so I guess we've only got, you know, 10 minutes or so. So I just wanted to note, like, actually got together with Fortisax and a few other Canadians at a little meetup in Toronto a couple of weeks ago. The first meeting of the Company of Adventurers. It was like, you know, we got together, we gave some speeches to a packed audience, actually, which was incredible that there were so many guys, so many young guys coming out just for an event like that. And so I look at things like that, I'm like, you know.
Is that going to be a regular event yearly?
It is planned to. I mean, I was not the organizer myself. I was simply invited, but... organizers say they want to sort of make these into, and not just like speeches, but like, you know, get people together and like go camping for like, you know, retreats out into the woods, you know, and sort of seriously start community building and like movement building.
Yeah, I think the organizer might have just posted on the live video on Twitter. I'm not sure if it's him. I don't want to read the name out just in case. But
okay.
Yeah, if the organizer wants to contact me, I could maybe have them on next year to help publicize that, help promote it.
Yeah, that's cool. This made me actually pretty feeling a bit more optimistic about Canada's own political future, like for the first time in a long time, actually, just because there were so many guys there. And the energy was really good. And I increasingly feel like we're sort of gathering together and like magnetizing the sensitive young men, as it were, and it's kind of gradually going to weld itself, self-organize itself into a political force that I think will be, in the long run, much more potent than an electoral party of the old mold.
Well, I mean, I hope so.
It's the only way out that I see, because I don't see mass politics as being viable in any of our countries. Because by the time you convince enough people of the need for remigration, for example. You know, well, you're not going to convince the migrants that they need to go home. And they're a pretty big chunk of the population, and they all get to vote. And then there's all the people in the population whose jobs involve caring for the migrants or using the migrants or what have you, you know, in some way, who benefit from them in some way. They're not going to vote for remigration. Are you really going to be able to get enough people in a coalition to just outvote those people? I'm skeptical, very skeptical. Which suggests that you're going to, that there need to be other options explored if our countries are going to survive.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. But let's end it there. I don't want to go into a big new thing there, even though we could. But let's keep it quite tidy. Darby asked the following. I don't know how much this happens in Europe, but in the US and Canada, universities will carve class grades due to the diversity not being able to pass in the more advanced fields like engineering and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
The state of modern academia.
Do you want
to comment on that?
Can we say they would carve class grades?
What he meant is manipulate upwards so that the...
There's massive grade inflation that happens. The standards get dropped dramatically, but like more often what they do is they just kind of ignore the grades. they'll even sometimes have like just different standards. Like I've seen examples in Canadian med programs at a couple of different universities, actually, where they would just say, okay, well, you know, here's the GPA you need if you're white, and here's the GPA you need if you're black, which is much lower, just to get into the program. Or they'll just have certain spots that are only open for diversity or what have you. So that happens a lot. There's just curricular standards being watered down because they'll notice that, and I've seen this happen myself, like in real time, where, you know, the professor is like the activist, the young female, it's always the women, young female activist professors, you know, they'll bring in their little diversity hires and they don't do so well because shocker. And then they stamp their feet and, you know, say, oh, well, you know, we have a retention problem and this is because of racism or sexism or what have you. And like, you know, point at the retention numbers, like, oh, look at this, like 80% of our black students who come in end up failing out after like 1 year, like, you know, and then they'll say like, well, why don't we change the program in this way, that way? And it's not, they never say we're going to lower the standards, but it's always lowering the standards. And if you stand against that, which some of the older professors will kind of grumble, and some of them will try to push back a little bit. And if they do that, there goes the reputation, you know, they'll get quietly canceled, or fired or sanctioned in some way. So, you know, then they learn quickly, don't do that. And the standards get lowered in any case. But then the problem is, of course, like when you lower the standards, you haven't eliminated the factors that led to the differential performance in the first place. So it's still like easier for one group to meet the lower standards than it is for the other group to meet the lower standard. Like that basic dynamic doesn't change. So the problem persists, and then they say, okay, well, we'll lower the standards again. And just over time, the overall quality of the program and the value of the degree just completely falls apart. Long-term, this is going to kill North American academia because the prestige associated with getting one of these degrees is, of course, a direct function of the difficulty of obtaining them. And when everyone knows that it's actually like absolute morons can get these if they just pay enough money, then no one's going to care. And at that point, the value of the degree is effectively nuked. And people stop going because what's the point?
Well, hopefully, hopefully they will.
No, we're already seeing that happen. Something like 25% of American universities have gone bankrupt in the last 10 years. And enrollment is down. I think it's like, I want to say about 20% from its peak in around 2011. That's partly just demographics. There's fewer kids, but there was a big, big drop during COVID, and it has not recovered from that. So, you know, fewer kids are attending, especially fewer young men. Young men are sort of just, I had a whole long essay, last plug I'll do, an essay called Academia's Women's Work, which the Twitter thread got like a million views or something, where I sort of like went through the social dynamics of male flight and the likely consequences of that for universities and the indications that we're already seeing the sort of first signs of that dynamic affecting universities.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. But look, we've got to end now because it's we should have ended about 10 minutes ago.
Your timing is perfect because my headphones just informed me that the battery is low.
Okay.
Well, I'm also just at the bottom of my my eggnog and Crown Royal here, so.
All right. Well, this has been a fun conversation. Is there anything you'd like to say just before we finish?
No. I think I've said everything I wanted to say. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay, great. Well, your links are below underneath the video, so I hope people have a look at your Substack and your Twitter.
So, thank you, Merry Christmas.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll be back in about 10 minutes with Fortisax. In the meantime, John Carter, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.